Okay, welcome everyone to the last Dallas Lawsters Forum meeting for the 2013-2014. We got some groans going on back there. 2013-2014
season.
I guess that's what it is. Not a semester. I always call it a semester. We're glad everyone is here. As you know, we're dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and great discussion to an interested audience in the DFW area. And I just want to thank everyone for coming out. And we meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. So as I said, this is our last one. Now, do we have any first-time visitors or second-time visitors? Okay. And who, how did you hear about it, sir?
Online through Meetup.
Okay. And the gentleman back there, this is your second time here, right?
I think it was
Meetup. Meetup as well? Okay. All right. Very good. Well, Carl, your hard work is paying off. Now, if you haven't paid already, some of you came in before our esteemed treasurer, the guy in the sharp-looking suit. It's $5, so if you haven't paid, then we appreciate after the lecture to come by and pay if you're a student. Any students here? We're all students of life, but any full-time college students? No, okay. Or high school students. Any junior high students? But it's $5 and $2 for students. And if you want to become a subscriber, it's $35 for 6 months worth of lectures. So that's a heck of a bargain. And also, every once in a while, we've had some problems where people forget to pay. And then we end up having to foot the bill. And we are a poor, non-for-profit organization. And so we really appreciate everyone remembering to pay your tabs. And if they haven't already included the tip in there, to generously tip your waitstaff. They do not. Okay, they did that for a while. But they're not doing that now. Some of them. Okay, well then check it out, because look at them pretty closely, because they may already have put the tip in there. Now, we are working diligently on our fall schedule. And here are some topics we've got coming up. We've got one opening left. And so I'm begging the board members to help me fill this slot. But we have topics on brilliance and creativity, environmental guilt and shame, which I don't even know if I should come to that one. Let a thousand gas wells bloom, fracking, and the philosophy of technology. So philosophy of technology and the philosophy of fracking, that's going to be pretty interesting, I think. Here's another one that's non-controversial. Is God a figment? A psychology of religion, thoughts, reflections, and inquiries. We are going to have a futurist topic on the world in 2034, 20 years from now. Ethical conundrums, challenges, and issues. And then lastly, we're going to have Dr. Josh Perrins with the University of Dallas speaking on why study pre-modern political philosophy. So that's going to be, will that be when they're, no, that's going to be right after the elections. So, what's that? Oh, okay.
Did you say Cal Gilson?
No, Josh Perrins. Yeah. So now I'd like to call up our esteemed, did I already call you esteemed before? Am I being redundant?
Well-dressed.
Official sartorial splendor, as my dad always used to say.
How about esteemed and broiled?
Esteemed and broiled. We're going to talk about our summer program, and I want you all to tell all your friends and family about it.
All your friends and family. Carl, hold up those programs. This is the flyer that we have for the summer program, the Philosopher's Jeopardy. This is really going to be exciting. We're going to have fun. It's going to be educational, competitive. We're going to have three different universities competing. There's going to be a lot of publicity, big turnout, we hope, at the Unity Church on Forest Lane in Dallas. And you've got the date there. And we're going to give cash prizes to the philosophy departments. All three of them will get some money. Of course, the winner will get the most. And we also will have a door prize. I'm not going to tell you what it is. But there will be a door prize for all attendees. And we do have a lot of expenses. We have $750 so far. Well, two more tonight, so that brings us up to $790. But we need much more. And so we need some donors, please. Your name and your information will be on the program in the back listed. You can have a space for $50 or $100. That'll get you like a business card type thing, advertisement. Or for $20, we just list your name. We had seven when we started tonight. We have five places left. And please, please, this is our last meeting of the year before this event. I'm really imploring anybody here, everybody, to, if you can see yourself, to donating at least $20 so we can, you know, make this a good thing. And I will provide you a letter for a tax deduction, tax deductible purposes. Huh?
What are the name of the universities that are participating?
SMU, the University of Arlington, Texas at Arlington, and University of Dallas. And the teams will be a faculty member will serve as coach, and two of the graduate students are two students of each university will be on the team competing, and our esteemed, he is esteemed too,
yes.
David Drum, our
be the MC.
Our attorney will be our MC for the program, and he's developing the question.
It's going to be a really cool graphics, and it's going to look like the real Jeopardy.
Yes, and we have graphics to the whole nine yards. So please, I want to see a show of hands of anybody who wants to give at least $20. Please put your hand up.
Jeez,
you're going to give it $20.
Everybody started giving $20 or more. Hold on, look at that. See? So please, this is our last opportunity, otherwise we're going to have to rob the bank.
Thank you very much.
I can help with
robbing the bank.
If I do your bank.
Okay, I want to mention that we have a website that has a lot of the same information. It's lawsourceforum.org. And if you type in Dallas Lawsource Forum in Google, Mr. Google, then it's going to give all the information. It's going to have FAQs. And so if you enjoy what you've seen tonight, then pass on that website to your friends. I'd also like to talk just briefly about, we need a volunteer to help us on AV, on social media. We're trying to do a little bit better job in social media, and a lot of us on the board are not. We're got a little bit of gray hair or losing our hair, and not really good with social media, and so we want to, you know, we're totally volunteer, no paid staff, and we really could use some help there to reach out more to the DFW area. We're strictly non-for-profit. So if you're interested, you know, please give that some thought. Get you some free meals at El Phoenix from time to time. So tonight our speaker will be presenting for about 45 minutes, and it'll open it up to questions. And so we'll do the questions in after his presentation. I ask you to please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode. And I also, before I introduce our speaker, I would like to thank his wife, Maren, for coming tonight. And she is an art teacher at one of the local elementary schools. So we're really glad that you're here, Maren. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. We're very privileged to have Dr. J. Michael Farmer with us tonight. Dr. Farmer is an associate professor at UTD. His area of specialization is Chinese history, especially early and medieval cultural, intellectual, and literary. He holds a BA in Chinese from the University of Texas. He's fluent in Mandarin, by the way. He holds master's degrees, two master's degrees in both Chinese history and Chinese literature from the University of Wisconsin. In addition, he earned his PhD in Chinese literature also from the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Farmer has published articles on various aspects of medieval China, including didactic illustrations in an early Chinese academy, a local historiography of medieval Sichuan, and the use of poetry in historical narrative. His book, The Talent of Shu, is a social and intellectual history of early Sichuan. He teaches several courses on Chinese history, including early China, medieval China, modern China, the Silk Roads, that's a topic in and of itself, I'm sure, and women in traditional China. He regularly translates literary, historical, and philosophical texts from China's early medieval period. He will be speaking this evening on the crisis of the Eastern Zhao and the rise of classical Chinese thought. And now, please join me in welcoming Dr. J. Michael Farmer.
Thanks, Rob. Am I mic'd up?
Yeah, you should be.
Not yet?
Well, you're on now.
I'm getting there. I'm hearing something. It's not a good talk without show and tell. I'll be pulling some of these things out here in just a moment. Rob, thank you very much for the invitation, for the opportunity to come here this evening to enjoy your company, and to be able to engage in a near impossible task, and that is to talk about the rise of classical Chinese thought in about 45 minutes. I have had to leave some very important and interesting figures and anecdotes on the editing room floor. And then listening to the titles of some of these upcoming events for next semester, I'm feeling very, very inadequate. I'm just going to give you guys this background information, and this stuff sounds really interesting. So here's hoping that I'm pitching myself in this lecture sufficiently low that you might find it okay at the end of the day. At any rate, most of us have encountered radio static in our heads. Most of us have encountered one or more classical Chinese philosophers in some form or other in our daily lives. Confucian wisdom served up on a slip of paper tucked inside a sweet cardboard-like cookie. It was invented either in New Jersey or San Francisco, depending on which history of American Chinese food you decide to adopt. The secrets of Taoism written across a nature scene on an internet meme. Or the strategic knowledge of Sun Tzu crouched in the curriculum of a management class. These encounters with ancient Chinese thought in the modern world would be might be insightful, they might be thought-provoking, perhaps even useful, but it sort of raises the question, are they real? Did Confucius really say that? Did Lao Tzu really say that? And by extension, we can go on to Buddha and to Einstein and to anybody else whose figure regularly shows up on the internet with some pithy saying plastered beneath his head. I think the question is, do the thinkers of China some 2,500 years ago have something relevant to say to us? And scholars of straight-up philosophy would argue, yes, 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 this is all very, very relevant. And I agree to this to a certain extent. But as an intellectual historian, I find myself much more interested in looking at that thought within its original context and tracing that thought as it leaves its original context and moves into a new historical and social and cultural and economic and political situation, and seeing how that thought evolves to fit that situation, how the people of that time mold some older idea to meet up with a contemporary need. And of course, this is far more than I could fit into 45 minutes to trace any of these ideas all the way down to the present time. So I've drawn a cutoff line about 200 BC. And we're not going to go much beyond that except in a couple of quick closing remarks. And that really sets the stage for the next kind of development. So my attempt this evening is to place the thought and activity of several key figures of the Confucian, the Taoist, and the legalist schools of thought back into their original historical context, as well as to highlight the main ideas and the socio-political programs of these classical Chinese thinkers. In essence, you get kind of a 45-minute overview of what a semester in early China class might be like. So here we find, I think, the way that we typically would think of a Confucius, right? Getting ready to write those fortune cookie ideas. He's sitting in the office, he's got a whiteboard for inspiration, and of course not everything is fortune cookie worthy, and so sometimes ends up over here. Confucius would have been a good three-point shooter in today's day and age. But we need to take Confucius out of the office, we need to put him back in the wild, if you will. The Zhou Dynasty begins somewhere around the year 1040 BCE, when the legendary King Wu, the son of the virtuous King Wen meaning the cultured king, overthrows the tyrant Zhou of the Shang Dynasty and establishes the Zhou Dynasty with a feudal political and social system. Its capital located near the city of Xi'an in sort of the inner northwest of China, and the capital area being under direct rule of the king. Okay, so again, by definition, we have this the royal domain with direct rule of the king. The outlying domains are then parceled out to his supporters. A number of them are kinsmen, others people who had helped he and his family to raise up in rebellion and to commit the act of regicide that brought them into power. The most important aspect of this Zhou conquest of Shang in 1040 are a series of political ideas that come into play. And they really all fall under this large umbrella of what we call, in modern Mandarin, Tongyi. And we could translate Tongyi as something like unified rule or unification. And there's a whole series of sort of individual ideas that come out of this obsession. And I don't think calling Tongyi or unified rule an obsession is probably underselling it rather than overselling it. The idea of a unified territory, the subcelestial realm, Tianxia, or all under heaven, ruled by a single ideology, the worship of Tian, or heaven, ruled by one sovereign, the Tianzi, the son of heaven, and supported by the mandate of heaven, Tianming. The idea that this ruler was favored by this quasi-divinity, because of his morality, because of his goodness, because of his virtue, to become the ruler. This sets up about three centuries of this early feudal rule. The royal court begins to lose power, the power and the autonomy of the dukes or the various lords in the outer domains begins to increase. And by the time we get to the year 770, we find a number of disaffected noblemen and some barbarians from the steppe land of the north and the west attacking the Zhou capital, killing the king and his favorite concubine because he was busy dallying with his favorite concubine instead of doing the moral things that he needed to be doing for government. The remnants of the court have to flee to the east, and they set up a new capital near the present-day city of Luoyang. And this marks the end of the Western Zhou and the beginning of what we call the Eastern Zhou, again, based on the geography of their capitals. The Eastern Zhou period runs from 770 down to 221 BC. So we've got about 500 odd years to work with. And this is a period of major changes, political fragmentation, and a profound political, moral, social, and economic crisis. And I want to outline these sets of changes, and particularly the views of the changes, in order for us to understand where Confucius is coming from. We've got to get out of the office, away from the whiteboard and the waste paper basket, and into the field. In terms of political changes during the Eastern Zhou, the rapid decline of the royal power, the new kings, okay, the person who becomes the first king of the Eastern Zhou is a somewhat distant relative of the king who'd been killed. He's in a weak political position to begin with. We see a gradual movement away from the practice of Tongyi, or unified rule. And this becomes somewhat disturbing. This has become a very, very important idea. We see the creation of a new political position, something that we call the Ba, or the Lord Protector. The Lord Protector was selected from the rulers of the various domains, who by this time, some of them are ceasing to call themselves dukes, the title they had been granted by the Zhou court, and are now beginning to call themselves kings, putting themselves at equal with the Zhou court. The Lord Protector was selected from a group of these dukes and feudal lords and would-be kings, and given the authority of protecting the central court. And this is really sort of a nominal authority. They didn't have any desire to really maintain the central court, but to maintain the pretext of the central court. This idea of unified rule, again, sort of casting a deep shadow over changes that are going on in the political landscape. Essentially, these Lord Protectors were warlords. They were looking out for their own interests, the interests of their states and their domains, their allies, and propping up a puppet king seems to work on this. We also see, parallel with the decline of the power of the king himself, we begin to see the decline of the power of the dukes and the lords of some of the other states. And then we begin to see the rise in power of other states. Okay, so the power balance is shifting away from the center to the provinces. The province powers are beginning to shift and morph. We find an increased amount of warfare. And the warfare prior to this time had largely been enacted by noblemen, horse and chariot based. They were more like chivalrous jousts, tournaments and feats of military skill that would determine outcomes. Very few people died. As we move into the Eastern Zhou period, we'll see some technological changes. The Iron Age begins around the year 500, and we get not only iron plows and farm tools, but we get iron blades, we get iron arrowhead tips, we get iron crossbow trigger mechanisms, making warfare a much more dangerous prospect. Perhaps not surprisingly, we see the aristocrats backing off of the front lines, and we see the conscription of farmers and peasants being armed with swords, spears, and crossbows and sent to the front lines. Warfare becomes more frequent, less chivalrous, more deadly, dare we say more democratic. Everyone can participate. In terms of the social changes involved, the hereditary aristocracy finds itself on the decline, and we begin to see the implementation of a system of meritocracy. You are a peasant, but you're a really good aim with that crossbow. The odds are you are going to find your position in society improving. There are lots and lots of accounts of commoners, people from the agricultural backgrounds, from commercial backgrounds, butchers and undertakers, okay, sort of almost unclean occupations, rising to the ranks of prime ministers because of their particular abilities and talents. And again, not surprisingly, this rapid change in social mobility becomes very, very disturbing, largely to the old nobility who are seeing their positions of power erode out from under them. In terms of the economic changes, again, the Iron Age begins around 500. We have weapons and tools. We also see major innovations in waterworks, particularly flood control and irrigation projects. The damming of rivers, the construction of weirs and new irrigation channels, opening up thousands and thousands of new acres of agricultural land. Higher food production leads to higher population. And so all of these things are again sort of moving us along. This is a chaotic period. Really, again, maybe sort of underselling the word chaos. In terms of polity, society, and economy, the changes were distressing to the rulers, the changes were distressing to the nobility, and to the population in general. Some people are benefiting, lots of people are losing out. And we begin to see the rise of a new occupation. Groups of traveling experts begin to pop up. And these are people who might be military strategists, they might be rhetoricians or experts in diplomacy. We have people who are agricultural experts, experts in social organization, mystics, and so forth. Turn it off real quick. The question of the day. Oh, I forgot my mouse. So we typically divide the Eastern Zhou into two periods, the Spring and Autumn period from 770 to 464, and the Warring States period from 463 to 221. The Zhou capital itself is this little tiny green space, and by the time we get into the Warring States period, this is really all the court controls. And these outlying areas, many of them have grown quite large. This is a late Warring States period snapshot. At its height, the Warring States period featured over 200 independent states and domains. But as this process of warfare continues, we see states gobbling up their neighbors. And eventually, the state of Chu, the state of Qin, the state of Yan remains some of the largest and most powerful states. The question of the day is, why is the sub-celestial realm, all under heaven, in such turmoil, and how can we make it stable again? And again, the shadow of Tongyi, of unified rule, is laying across the land. It's not a question of how do we move forward with this new plurality of states and ideas, it's how do we get everything back together again. During the late Zhou period, a multitude of thinkers are vying for the attention of the rulers of the fractured Zhou realm, each of them offering their own remedies for the socio-political chaos of the age. And to a Western mind, the notion of a plurality of voices, each debating among the whole, is something we might view as open, as liberal, as ideal. However, the Chinese of the late Zhou viewed the lack of a central ideology and everything else that had fallen apart in terms of unified rule or Tongyi as a tragedy and as chaos. And they longed to bring the sub-celestial realm back together under the sway of a single enlightened ruler, a sage with a unified philosophical position. So from here, I want to introduce you to the major figures of the three most important schools. Again, this is sliding some other important schools that we simply won't have time to get. I want to talk first about the Confucians, and then we'll move on and we'll talk about the Taoists and we'll talk about the legalists and perhaps some resolution to this problem. As far as Confucius goes, Confucius was a man named Kongxiu, whose purported dates were 551 to 479 BC. The Kong is his surname, Xiu is his given name. Kong is an honorific, it means something like Master Kong. And about the 15th, 16th century, when Jesuit missionaries got to China and began encountering Confuzi, they Latinized this into Confucius. So this is how you get Confucius out of Kong. He was a native of the state of Chu, the state of Lu, and a city called Shufu. This is in the sort of east-central portion of China. It's in present-day Shandong province. And he was of aristocratic birth. However, his own family was impoverished. And yet despite his family's poverty, he was able to acquire an education. And Kongxiu's goal was to be an official, to be a government official, to be able to put his ideas into practice. He ends up becoming essentially an itinerant political philosopher, political consultant. He held a couple of low-level positions, but never found a ruler who was willing to buy into his program. And as a result, he turned to teaching. I guess it was his fallback gig. And ended up taking on students from all levels of society. The teachings of Confucius were not written down in they were not written by Confucius himself as part of any kind of coherent philosophical or political or social discourse. Rather, they were the oral teachings that were passed down through his disciples, who upon his death gathered together for what we might consider a wake and shared stories of their master. And so we have Confucius' students and their students, and even some of their students, so grand students and great-grand students, however we want to think about them. And these reminiscences of their conversations with Confucius and with Confucius' disciples and the conversations between the disciples are all gathered and collected in this book called the Lunyu, or the Analects. It's a collection of dialogues that largely provides insight into the daily activities and behavior of Confucius and his disciples. And through these dialogues and these teachings, we get a general idea of his individual personality. And this is one, kind of a cool thing. We're able to go back in and listen to these, listen in on these students talking about their master or their great-grandmaster and figure out what kind of a guy he was. Well, if we piece together some of these things, we can put together the kind of snapshot. Yes, ma'am.
Are those Chinese writings all the same? They're like different Chinese alphabets.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all the same font on the slide. Yeah, they're all different characters. So you got, this is his name, Cole, this is Cho, this is Cole, this is Tzu, this is the name of the book, the Lun Yu, this is his home state, the state of Wu, and so forth. Yeah. Don't give me too deep on it. I'm pretty sure that I got that slide right. We find Confucius to be proper, yet relaxed. Taking joy in simple food and lodging. And sadly, he comes off as a very an individual who feels like he's misunderstood. And at the end of his life, he comes off as an individual who feels like he's a failure. It's kind of interesting. Confucius's answer to the question of why is the world in such turmoil is fairly simple. He says, Tian Sha Wu Dao. The sub-celestial realm, or the empire, has no morality. Morality has gone. It's declined. And he's seeking to revive the concern for morality that he thought had been present at the founding years of the Zhou dynasty, back in 1040. The King Wen and his son King Wu, and the benevolent regent, the Duke of Zhou, and these figures from ancient history in his own time. He looks to the past, to the Zhou dynasty, the early Zhou dynasty rulers, as the models for the present. And this is going to be sort of the hallmark Confucian methodology of dealing with a problem, whether this is in Confucius' day or with later Confucians. What does the past have to teach us about the present? And how can we apply those models of the past with today? Confucius reads the lessons of the past in an interesting way. He begins by classifying people, and he argues that there are three general types of people in the world. At the top, there's the sage, the shengren, there's the gentleman, the junzi, and the petty man, the xiaoren. I'll talk about the sage in just a moment. The petty man is someone who's concerned only with profit, who's only looking out for himself. The junzi, the gentleman, is someone who is moral, someone who is ethical, someone who is concerned with doing what is right. And he looks to, again, the past, and pulls out these examples of people that he identifies as being gentlemen or sages. All right, now I'm going to tap into the book here. Lots of little pink tabs on it. Hopefully we can find all of the right spots. In defining a sage. Confucius was reported to have said the following. One of his disciples, a man named Zogong, asks him, if one were able to bestow much upon the common people and bring succor to the multitudes, what would you make of him? Could such a person be called good? And this is actually referring back here to this virtue of benevolence. The master said, why stop at good? Such a person should surely be called a sage. When someone like Yao or Shun, legendary rulers from even earlier than the Zhou, would find such a task daunting, desiring to make a stand, one who is good helps others to take their stand. Wanting to realize himself, he helps others to realize themselves. Being able to take what is near at hand as an analogy could perhaps be called the method of goodness. Someone who helps others, someone who takes care of the people, one who executes a compassionate government, in Confucius' eyes, is a sage. Confucius goes on to say that he has no hope of actually meeting a sage in that fallen age that he lives in. But it is very possible for one to become a gentleman. And this is the best we can hope for, and this is what we do. So how does one become a gentleman? One becomes a gentleman through self-cultivation, and self-cultivation primarily through education. The opening lines of the Analects, Book 1, Verse 1, the master says, to learn and then have occasion to practice what you have learned, is this not satisfying? To have friends arrive from afar, is this not joy? To be patient in even when others do not understand, is this not the mark of the gentleman? And he goes on to talk about the process of education. Speaking of himself, he says in Book 2, Verse 4, at 15, I set my mind upon learning. At 30, I took my place in society. At 40, I became free of doubts. At 50, I understood heaven's mandate. At 60, my ear was attuned. And at 70, I could follow my heart's desires without overstepping the bounds of propriety. In essence, this is a lifelong process of cultivation. One does not wake up and decide, I'm going to be good and I'm going to become a gentleman. But one has to do this step at a time, long haul. As one pursues education, one will then cultivate various virtues, various qualities. Filial piety, that is reverence and loyalty to one's parents. And with early China is very much a family-centered society, and the political world is viewed as an extension of the family. And so we see then making the jump from filial piety to loyalty, that is loyalty to one's sovereign, to one's superiors in the social and political hierarchy. And so the filial piety is the virtue that one learns at home. The outward public projection of this is loyalty. Righteousness, proper action, is how he would define this. Know your role and act accordingly. If you are the ruler, you act like a ruler. If you are the subject, you act like the subject. If you are the older brother, you act like the older brother. If you are the younger brother, you act like the younger brother. If you happen to be in the middle of two siblings, guess what? You get to play both roles, depending on who you're interacting with. You act the younger brother in your interactions with your elder brother, and you act the older brother to the younger brother. So one has to understand then one's place in a hierarchical society and one's role. And this notion of E or righteousness is everything about understanding where you are and acting the part. The chief of the virtues for Confucius, though, is this notion of benevolence or goodness, as we've been reading in this particular translation. This encompasses all of the others. Confucius makes the argument that unless men individually embrace goodness or benevolence or kindness, and again, our Jesuits who come in a little bit later really like the translation of this term as charity, because there's a nice New Testament equivalent that they can latch onto. Unless individual men embrace benevolence, then there was no hope, according to Confucius, that society at large could be reformed. That the only way to fix this problem is to fix it an individual at a time. And one does this through education and through something that we commonly call ritual or propriety, the standards of proper conduct. And that is knowing that how you're supposed to behave in one situation versus another, knowing how to properly take care of a funeral and all kinds of minutiae. Okay, so if we going back sort of to a biblical comparison, if you like the detailed prescriptions for life found in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, you would love the ritual text of early Confucianism. How long do you mourn for your stepmother, but how long do you mourn for a stepmother who may have adopted you as a son versus a stepmother who did not adopt you for a son? And how long do you wear the hempen sackcloth in white versus the hempen sackcloth in black? Again, hair-splitting details that one has to know. But these are all viewed as the outward manifestation. If you live to the letter of the ritual code, the law, you are cultivating these inner virtues. And if you have cultivated these inner virtues, then you will naturally want to live the law, to walk the walk. In terms of government, again, this is something that Confucius is very concerned about. He wants to be a government official. He points out something quite obvious in the Chinese language. He says, "Zhengye," to govern or to rule is to correct or to make proper. There is an equivalent between this notion of correction and rule. Moving back now from the teachings and looking sort of at the Confucian philosophy in a more broad context, the early Confucian philosophy was very much centered toward the problems of human society and the state. Okay? The teachings focus on what he believes constituted a good harmonious society, good government, and particularly harmonious human relations. Okay? Know your part, act your part. And if everybody does what they're supposed to, then everybody gets along. So there's very much a collectivist idea here as well. He taught the rulers, or wanted to teach the rulers, how to be virtuous. He emphasized the duties that the rulers had to their inferiors and the subordinates owed to their superiors. The ideas of filial piety and proper conduct and so forth. Despite the later influence of his teachings, he thought himself a failure. He never got the advising job that he wanted. He never found a ruler who was willing to try this stuff. And as he lived his life, the political, social, and economic, and military chaos continued to get worse. So it's kind of easy to figure out why he would die depressed and feeling that nobody got it. There are two important figures who come out of the Confucian school. The first of these is a man named Meng Zi, also sometimes Latinized as Mencius, and a slightly younger contemporary named Xunzi. Now, unlike Confucius, Meng Zi actually did sit down and write a book. And we have, he wrote 7 short books that are now collected as part of what we call the Meng Zi. Most of these are highly likely to have been written by him himself, and most of them take the forms of conversations and dialogues. Okay, so again, sort of a philosophical teaching method that we're familiar with from the West. After the death of Confucius, there was no single figure who really dominated the Confucian school. His various disciples tended to break off and emphasize different ideas. And so you had people who promoted filial piety to the exclusion of other things, and people who promoted ritual to the exclusion of other, or music, and so forth. By the time we get to Meng Zi, though, a number of Confucian ideas have filtered out into society and become not so much the proprietary ideas of the Confucians themselves, but have become more of a general Chinese foundation. Things like education, the access to books, the study of books, copying out manuscripts, annotating them, and distributing these copies was the chief activity of the intellectuals of the Eastern Zhou. Okay, they're really working as scribes. And again, we could move this into a medieval Western context, and we look at the monastic scene, when these people are doing nothing but copying out texts and circulating them. There were public debates as matters of entertainment. And so very representatives of various schools would be brought together by kings, by dukes, by aristocrats, and led to have these kind of public discussions. And the role of a traveling political advisor becomes a very accepted thing. So whereas Confucius died thinking he was a failure because all he was a traveling political advisor who nobody listened to him, eventually he sort of creates the blueprint for a job, for a career path. There are a couple of things that are important to mention about these two figures. Ideas that Confucius never really talked about. Confucius is worried about human society. And he doesn't really worry so much about the basic question of human nature. Who are people? What are we like fundamentally? But this is something that by the time we get to Mengzi's age is a really hot topic. And Mengzi and Xunzi are usually paired together. One, because they were contemporaries. They were rivals in some sense. And they both spoke at length on two particular topics. The first of these has to do with human nature. Mengzi makes the argument that at birth, everyone is good. Everyone is born with good inclinations. But they can become corrupted by the world around them. And he makes a particular... Let's see if I can get the right... A very, very famous analogy. This is in the second book of Mencius. He says, humans all have hearts that are not unfeeling towards others. The former kings had hearts that were not unfeeling towards others. So they had governments that were not unfeeling towards others. If one puts into practice a government that is not unfeeling towards others, by means of a heart that is not unfeeling towards others, bringing order to the whole world is in the palm of your hand. Just be nice. Care about people. Take care of them. The reason why I say that humans all have hearts that are not unfeeling towards others is this. Suppose someone suddenly saw a child about to fall into a well. Everyone in such a situation would have a feeling of alarm and compassion, and not because one sought to get in good with the child's parents, and not because one wanted fame among the neighbors and friends, and not because one would dislike the sound of a child's cries. We do good things because it's part of our basic nature. According to Mengzi. On the other hand, Xunzi, a man named Xunqing, and if again, the Zi here is the honorific, so it's Master Xun and Master Meng, like we have Master Kong, and so forth. Xunzi is an important bridge, an intellectual bridge, between the Confucians, between the Taoists, and between the legalists. A really important figure. He was highly influenced by Confucius and by Zhuangzi, one of our early Taoist thinkers that I'll mention in just a minute. And two of his students become the most important early legalist thinkers. His book, The Xunzi, was written by him, by Xunqing, and also in the form of philosophical arguments and dialogues. So again, we can read these two texts against each other quite easily. In regards to human nature, whereas Mengzi said that goodness is innate, Xunzi says that human nature is basically crude or unrefined. And if you have a chance to read from Xunzi, let's see if we can find our spot here. For example, in this particular translation, we find, this is chapter 23, human nature is bad. And sometimes we read it, human nature is evil. Okay? The Chinese term for this is And in modern Chinese, we tend to translate as something like bad or evil. But in the late Zhou Dynasty Chinese, this term means something more like crude or unrefined. Okay? Think of, we live in Texas. We understand what crude means in an oil context. Okay? It's something that has come out of the ground that has not been processed. And this is what Xunzi is talking about. Human nature is crude or unrefined. And it must be processed through education. Okay, again, so here's this foot in the Confucian door. Here he is taking a diametrically opposite position with Mengzi, who has become essentially the leader of the Confucian school. I should say this about Mengzi, too. He was not the least bit shy, was not the least bit humble. He was a rock star. A rap star of the age. He traveled with an entourage that would make P, whoever, Diddy, whatever, pale in comparison. Okay, this guy was quite full of himself. They talk about this, the two of them could be easily compared and contrasted with their ideas on human nature, with government and morality. For Mengzi, he follows very close to the two Confucius' idea that one should persuade people by setting a moral example. That is, the king is moral, and the high ministers who interact with the king will be moral. And then the mid-level ministers who interact with the high-level ministers will see that example, and they will be moral. And those mid-level ministers who interact with the local magistrates, the magistrates will see that, and they will take that on. One of my former colleagues described this as trickle-down morality. And it sadly worked about as well as the its namesake economic theory. There were no place for laws for Mengzi. It was simply moral example. You do what you're supposed to, people will see that, and they will model that in themselves. Xunzi, on the other hand, begins to argue that one requires law to make people become moral. You educate them, and when they don't do what they're supposed to do, you smack them around. And this is easy now to see how he becomes a forerunner of the legalist. His two students will take this thing and run with it. And in turn, the third interesting area, point of comparison, a wrap up here. Excuse me? Oh, okay. I heard something, but I wasn't sure what it was. Okay, thank you. Has to do with social welfare. And for an egotist, Mengzi was also very much a populist. He has the idea that the ruler is responsible for the social welfare of his subjects, that they be provided with safety, with protection, with an adequate living. And a ruler who fails to do so would be found to have lost the mandate of heaven, okay, this semi-divine right to rule. Mengzi argues that heaven hears as my people hear, and if the people are impoverished, if the people are fighting, dying in wars, if there are hardships, and they are crying their complaints, heaven will hear that and will remove this person. The extension that Mengzi goes on to argue, and again, it's kind of interesting for the kind of guy that he was, the people have a right to rebel. An immoral ruler must be overthrown in order to live in accord with heaven's will and heaven's mandate. So he's very much a populist thinker. Mengzi, the egotist populist, the populist egotist, something along those lines, and stays very, very close in many regards to the original teachings of Confucius. Moving into the second major school, our Taoists, or particularly our classical Taoists, there are two important sources for early Taoism. Two texts, the text known as the Laozi and a text known as the Zhuangzi. And the Laozi, also known by its later title of the Tao Te Ching, the classic of the Way and its potency, or the Way and its power, but please never the Way and its virtue. It's a whole pedantic thing that I won't waste time on here, but I can tell you about it later. The Laozi, the Tao Te Ching, or the classic of the Way and its potency, is a collection of rhymed aphorisms. Okay? It's poetry, folks, that express a set of principles that are intended for application, surprise, in a political setting. Okay? Now, despite what your favorite cashier at your favorite New Age bookstore may tell you, the Laozi is a political text. It is addressed to a ruler, and it is a different take on how to deal with the problems of the Eastern Zhou. There are two sections of the book. In the most commonly received version of the text, the first section is the Tao section, the text on the way. The way is viewed as the ultimate cosmic force, It is something that is impersonable. It is ineffable. As soon as you begin to speak about it, you've missed the mark. The opening lines of the Tao section say something like, Tao ka Tao, Fei Chang Tao, Ming ka Ming, Fei Chang Ming. The Tao that can be spoken of, or the Tao that can be trod, depending on how you read the character of Tao, because it has multiple meanings, is not the constant Tao. The name that can be named is not the constant name. As soon as you try to pin a tail on it, you've missed it. And so the text is majestically vague as it attempts to talk around what the Tao is not and what the Tao is like. It never says the Tao is, because then it's wrong. It is non-being. It is undifferentiated. It is passive. And we frequently find metaphors of passivity. The female, the mother, the child, water, the valley, weakness, being used to talk up the virtue of the Tao. The good characteristics of the Tao all come from being passive. The Da section, the potency, the power section, is a political treatise directed to a would-be ruler of state. So if we look at these two sections, the Tao section is a little bit more metaphysical. The Da section is very much socio-political. The traditional received text has the Tao section first, the Da section second. Mother Earth has been very kind to Chinese archaeologists and philosophers in the last 30 or 40 years. And we have excavated at least a half a dozen new issues, editions of the Laozi that predate the received text, and every single one of them has the Da section first, indicating that in its original fashion, the political chapters go before the metaphysical chapters. The kind of government that the Da sections of the text advocate, a government of the sage. Well, this is like Confucius, but the definition of the sage is going to be very, very different. Same word, different meaning. Of knowledge, a sage who has no knowledge, who has no desires. It is simple. It is very much a primitivist political and social philosophy. A sage rules in a passive manner, according to Laozi. The idea of Wu Wei, Wu Wei, which doesn't mean doing nothing. It's sometimes translated as non-action. But what it really means is doing nothing that is not natural. And so, if you are a farmer, what is natural for you to do as part of your occupation? Well, you plant seeds, you water, you weed, you harvest, you keep the deer out, okay? Whatever it is you have to do. This is what is natural. What is not natural for a farmer? To be given a crossbow, a spear, a sword, and sent out to the front line. A Taoist sage ruler allows the people to do what is natural for them. If there had been a hereditary class of soldiers, what would have been natural for them? Well, crossbows, spears, swords, and so forth. The farmers do their thing, the soldiers do their thing. The Tao Te Ching talks in a number of places about doing nothing, yet having nothing left undone. And so, again, there's sort of this, you know what you have to do. I use this example with my students. You are students. What is natural for you to do? Well, you read. You do your homework. You come to class prepared. You participate. What is unnatural for you to come over and do my yard work, to put a new roof on my house? If I am the kind of professor that makes you come over and do manual labor for me, I am causing you to do things that are not natural for your place in the world. So in this we see also an understanding and an acceptance of hierarchy within society, with particular roles. So while the Confucians tend to get pigeonholed as being the ones who are obsessed with social structure and hierarchy and role play, the Taoists are also involved in this. And so this becomes sort of a common feature. The government of the sage is simple. And I want to share with you one particular passage. This is from chapter 80. And it's frankly my favorite chapter in the whole book. That's saying something. Reduce the size of the state. lessen the population. Make sure that even though there are labor-saving tools, they are never used. Make sure that the people look upon death as a weighty matter and never move to distant places. Even though they have ships and carts, they will have no use for them. Even though they have armor and weapons, they will have no reason to deploy them. Make sure that the people return to the use of the knotted cord. And this is actually using it for economic transactions, right? You have five oxen, you tie five knots in the cord. That means get rid of writing. Okay, you get rid of the more sophisticated tool for keeping records. Make their food savory, their clothes fine, their houses comfortable, their lives happy. Then, even though neighboring states are within sight of each other, even though they can hear the sounds of each other's dogs and chickens, their people will grow old and die without ever having visited one another. This is the Taoist blueprint, or at least the Lao Tzu blueprint, for fixing the problems of the Eastern Zhou. You have all this technology, put the crap away. You can see your neighbors, but don't go bother them. Stay home and do what it is you need to do. Do what is natural for you.
Be happy, don't worry.
Yeah, something like that. Don't worry, be happy. Be happy, don't worry. It's a social analog to a term that comes up in the Lao Tzu a number of times. It's a Chinese term called huan dun, and it means chaos. And not chaos in a bad way, but chaos as in an undifferentiated state. The idea that the cosmic force of the Tao is churning like a pot of soup. Anybody here like wonton soup? Anybody ever watched it in the pot? You've got the dumplings and you've got the other stuff going in here. You've been eating chaos soup. Wonton. Okay. This is the natural state of the cosmos. Things are churning and they are undifferentiated. This society, of course, does not exist, and Lao Tzu argues that civilization has brought about a fall from this primitive idea, and that civilization is not permanent, and it's not necessarily superior to the early undifferentiated primal experience. His colleague, the good old days, and so again, they're all looking to the past. Confucius looks to the days of the early Zhou, Lao Tzu looks to the Chinese Flintstones. Back into the Stone Age or something. Zhuangzi, the second important Taoist philosopher, wrote about a third of the book that bears his name, and it doesn't really contain much in the way of political advice. If you want to be a personally practicing Taoist, Zhuangzi is your guy. Okay? He is promoting an individual type of philosophy. He is an anti-rationalist. He is all for breaking down distinctions. So the social order that Lao Tzu accepts, the social order that the Confucians are promoting, out the window with Zhuangzi. He attacks our faith in knowledge. He attacks very directly many of the other schools of philosophy in his age. Zhuangzi is really fun to read because he's always picking at somebody. He picks on Confucius, and then just when you think he's picking on Confucius, he has Confucius pick on somebody else, saying words that Confucius would never have said. And so about half the time Confucius appears here, he's a puppet. Lao Tzu's got his hand up here moving the mouth, making him say all kinds of fun things. Perhaps the ideal quote from Zhuangzi that would sort of encapsulate the Zhuangzi as a personal philosophy. Zhuangzi was fishing by the Pu River, and the king of Chu sent two officials to him, saying, "We would like to trouble you with the administering of our kingdom, as we want to make you the prime minister." Without looking up from his pole, Zhuangzi said, "I heard Chu has a sacred turtle. It's been dead 3,000 years, and the king keeps it wrapped and boxed and stored up in his ancestral hall. Now, would that turtle rather have its bones treasured in death, or be alive dragging its tail in the mud?" The two officers said, "It would rather be alive dragging its tail in the mud." Zhuangzi says, "Go, I'll keep my tail in the mud, too." Zhuangzi wants us to look at the world in a different fashion. And he questions, what do we know? How do we know what we know? And in probably the most widely quoted of the parables of Zhuangzi, we find in chapter 2, one night Zhuangzi dreamed. Zhuangzi dreamed of being a butterfly. A happy butterfly, showing off and doing as he pleased, unaware that he was Zhuangzi. Suddenly, he awoke. drowsily Zhuangzi again. And he could not tell whether it was Zhuangzi who had dreamt the butterfly or the butterfly dreaming Zhuangzi. But there must be some difference between them. This is called the transformation of things. And this is something that he does not necessarily like. He likes to keep things spontaneous. And if you ever want to read something wonderful about death, Zhuangzi, chapter 6, the death of one of his friends, a natural process of change and something not to be feared, but something to be embraced for the mystery, for the challenge, for the fun that it might take. His friend hopes that in death he will get a rooster growing out of his left arm. Exactly what I'm hoping for, too. Very quickly, the legalists, who are everything that we would think with a group called the legalists. They were very concerned about this, about law, about order. And the state of Qin in the Northwest adopts legalism. Han Fei and Li Si, these two particular thinkers, were students of Xunzi, and so we have that sort of family tree coming out of the Confucian and the Taoist school. Han Fei, a man after my heart, or at least after the heart of the legislators, blamed social disorder on useless scholars and their blind acceptance of history and antiquity. So Han Fei would hate me just as much as somebody in Austin might hate me. He argues that different problems of the age require different ideas. And the classic analogy that he gives for this: among the people of Song, there was a farmer who had a stump in the middle of his field. One day a rabbit was running across the field and crashed into the stump and broke its neck and died. Seeing this, the man put aside his plow and took up watch next to the stump, hoping that he would get another rabbit in the same way. But of course, he could not get another rabbit like this, and he soon became the laughing stock of the entire state of Song. Now, if one wants to use the government of the former kings to bring order to the people of the current age, this is all just so much stump watching. He gets into the human nature argument and argues that all men are selfish and that only through law can they be made virtuous, that they act as from their own self-interest. Legalism, as a larger philosophy, advocates a very strong central government that can exercise absolute power by the threat of harsh punishments, publicly posted laws, public rewards, and public punishments, with everyone except for the king being subject to these. They seek to break down the patriarchal family, and they organize families into groups mutually responsible for each other's behavior. And if somebody did something good, the entire group was rewarded. If somebody did something bad, the entire group was punished, unless somebody ratted out the people. They had no faith in an individual moral ruler, and they favored an impartial system. We're getting close?
Yeah.
Okay. This was adopted by the state of Qin in the 3rd century BCE. And eventually this guy here, with his self-titled, the first emperor of Qin, is able to win out military struggle against the remaining states and bring China back to this state of Tongyi, of unified rule. One son of heaven, one territory, one ideology, legalism. And in fact, the emphasis on the one ideology was so strong that private copies of any text other than legalist, agriculture manual, or medical handbook were burned. A large group of private scholars were killed for privately teaching these things. He was very successful. This particular figure is his ancestors and the legalist philosophy in creating order and unity out of a chaotic age. But ultimately, legalism under the Qin proved to be too harsh. And shortly after his death, a civil war erupted, and the dynasty fell. And with the fall of the Qin, other schools of thought like Confucianism and Taoism reemerged, with a syncretic form of Confucianism eventually becoming the state ideology under the Han Dynasty, roughly 200 BC to 200 CE. And it's during this period of the Han Dynasty that Taoism reemerges as a religion of salvation, very, very distant from the philosophies of Lao Tzu and Zhuangzi that we briefly touched upon. Buddhism enters China, and we really see a whole other philosophical age. And so we'll close the curtain on my lecture this evening here at the fall of the Qing Dynasty. One of the great legacies, of course, is his tomb. Anybody here been to Xi'an and seen the Terracotta Warriors? Okay, so these are the guys here. And again, he's a subject of a whole other hour or more of material. So I'll leave it there. I'm going to drink of water, and you can ask me questions here.
We've got about 10-15 minutes for a Q&A. I would ask respectfully that you keep your comments under 30 seconds when we get you a question. I won't time you per se, but try not to make your comments too long. So who wants to start off? Anyone? Well, I've got one. You talked about the masters. To become a master, was there a formal educational program in order to achieve, or was it primarily via tutors that one became a master?
So the honorific that we see here with the master, these are typically posthumous designations, and they come from the disciples and the grand disciples. This is a way of honoring the intellectual lineage that one comes from. The kind of teaching that was going on, Confucius is the first private teacher. Sort of large scale. And after Confucius, his disciples continue on that vocation, and as we move through this time period, lots and lots of these different schools and approaches have private teachers. And again, this is a way of, sensei to your Japanese master, professor or doctor to your professor, your master here. Simply an honorific that's bestowed.
I'm talking about education as far as self-actualization and all that Confucius wrote about or talked about. Was that available to the peasants? I assume not, or
actually,
how did that work?
Confucius was very, very open to who he would take as a student. His students ranged the gamut of the social ladder. He had sons of the aristocracy, and he had very, very poor. His most beloved and most brilliant and too tragically died young disciple, Yin Hui, was one of the poorest. And so Confucius said something to the effect that I'll take on anyone who's willing to learn. If you want to learn, come on in, whether you can pay for it, what kind of a background you bring to the program.
Okay, very good. Who else? Someone else got a question.
How did you come to study this? How old were you?
I first got exposed to Chinese language and culture when I was about 21. And I spent a couple of years in Taiwan doing some volunteer service work. Learned enough language and figured out that I didn't want to be a starving art student for the rest of my life. So I came back home and pursued the far less lucrative career in academia. It started out with language and being on the ground in Taiwan for a couple of years, and then deciding that I wanted to figure out how far I could ride this.
Well, that's a difficult language. Are you just gifted with languages?
No, I nearly flunked Spanish in high school, it was really a matter, I think, of being in the right place to be in an immersion environment. I heard this every day. I had to use it. If I couldn't speak Chinese, I couldn't eat. I couldn't find the bathroom. Necessity. But it came relatively quickly. And I have friends who were in the same program that maybe didn't come so quickly. But I've been working on it now since 1986, and I'm still plugging along. People ask, how fluent are you? Well, I know enough Chinese to get in trouble, and I can sometimes get myself back out of trouble. These days I read probably better than I speak, because I'm here most of the time, but I'm involved in a large translation project, and it's part of my research, and so the reading thing has really come back.
Question back here, Dr. Farmer.
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes, I'm wondering to what extent there was exchange of ideas between the Chinese culture around 2,000 years ago and Western, like Egyptian, well, probably Greek and Indian ideas. You said Buddhism got there eventually. Mm-hmm. But on the Silk Road, do you think there might have been a lot of exchange even earlier?
Oh yeah, again, this is a topic of great interest to me. Buddhism gets to China in the first century of the Common Era. And it is brought across the Silk Roads by traveling merchants and eventually missionaries who come across. Prior to that time, say 2000 to 1200 BCE, we have evidence of Indo-Europeans who have been buried and discovered in the far west areas of China. These folks were probably Tocharian, very closely related by genetics and linguistics to the Celts. That's a whole wonderful story. There's a book called The Mummies of Urumqi that is for a sort of a general reader book that cracks this mystery. One of my friends and mentors at the University of Pennsylvania sort of stumbled across these red-haired Caucasian mummies in this rundown provincial backwater museum and put together an international team of historians, linguists, textile folks, and genetics DNA folks. There's smuggled samples of DNA out of the country. And I mean, it's a great, almost a sort of a spy thriller before they finally figured out who these people were. What did they give to China? Fully developed horse and chariot technology. The Shang Dynasty elites control power because of their horse and chariot technology. They appear at full bloom, no prototypes, no failures, at the same time that we've got these Indo-Europeans out there. And so there's a small leap to take, but it's my friend who was sort of a crackpot, or everybody thought he was a crackpot, until this project finally came to full development. And really quite amazing in looking at those links. So yeah, the contacts go back very, very far, and by the time we get to that first century CE and onward, the Silk Roads are very important with Persian middlemen linking China, India, and the Mediterranean. Other questions?
Time for one more question.
At the beginning of the discussion, you commented that was a period of economic, social, and political chaos. And we are now in the midst of another period of economic, social, and political chaos. And I wondered if you saw some lessons that could be drawn from that period to this.
Yeah, I'm going to keep my tail in the mud. I think there are aspects of all of the schools of thought that one could apply. There was a story in the news about 2.5 years ago. A young child was run over by a car in a marketplace in Guangdong province and left to die in the street with a dozen or so people stepping over the body until a homeless bag lady came and moved the child out of the way. And this caused an amazing crisis in the Chinese discourse. How have we gotten so inhumane to walk over the body of a small child who's been hit by a car? How can you be such a jerk as to run somebody over and not stop? So I have a copy of this news release that includes a lot of excerpts from Chinese Twitters and so forth. And I asked my students to write about this. What would these guys say about that event? How would Confucius, how would Mencius, how would Xunzi, how would the legalists, the Taoists look at an event like this? And I think it's a really useful exercise to try to then take the thought of 2,000 plus years ago and apply it to a very, very specific issue. I mean, we can sort of say, we have problems today, how can we do it? Here's a very specific problem. And I think it's a very good exercise, and I get some very insightful responses. Ones that made me feel like, wow, my students are actually getting what these people were saying, how these people were approaching those problems. I apologize, I talked too long.
Oh, no.